I love to teach. In fact, I can't remember a time when I didn't love to teach. I grew up with a dream that maybe someday I could become a teacher. You see, my teachers changed my life. And when I think back over the people who have truly touched me for good, many of them have turned out to be teachers. I'll never forget my second grade Sunday school teacher, Mrs. Charles Anderson. After all these years, she still teases me that she taught me everything I know. I remember my sixth grade public school teacher, Mrs. Rudin, who made learning come alive in a way that I've never quite gotten over. And then there was my high school English teacher, Mr. Simmons, who believed that every T should be crossed and every I dotted, who made me do it over and over and over again until it was absolutely perfect. Thanks, Mr. Simmons. And then there were a very few special teachers, the rare ones, the ones who taught beyond their notes and went for our hearts. They reached me in ways that I'm unable to fully describe. All I know is that when I walked out of their classes, I left a better person than when I walked in. They had left their mark on my life. They had molded my character. And how I value them today, much of what I've become, is because of what they taught me. They were the men and the women who taught me the truth, continued the tradition that my godly parents had started. Maybe now you can understand why I wanted to be a teacher. It's because my teachers changed my life. Therefore, when I think of teaching, I couldn't think of a higher calling or a more noble profession. Perhaps you've not thought about it quite like this, but all of us are teachers. Every day, all of us influence someone in some way. For instance, if you're a parent, then you teach your children all the time, whether you know it or not. They are forever learning from us, even when we don't think we're teaching them. And if you're an older man or an older woman, then you are commanded by God Himself to teach those who are younger than you. Because without your wisdom, without your counsel, so many will stumble and fall. And more than one may never become what they could have become had you not come along and rescued them with the lessons that you had learned. If you're an employer, you'd better be teaching and training your employees all the time, because if you don't, your competition will pass you by just like that. Since it's all true, then, that all of us teach all of the time, perhaps we should all pay a little bit more attention to this thing we call teaching. Perhaps it's time to begin giving teaching the place of honor that the Lord Himself has given it. Just think about it for a moment. Teaching lies at the very heart of Jesus. You see, not only was Christ the truth, but He taught the truth. In fact, no matter where you find Him in the Gospels, Jesus was always teaching. Teaching the 5,000, teaching the 12, teaching the inner circle, or even teaching only the one. It made no difference. Without a doubt, more than anyone else that I know, Jesus was the teacher, the master teacher. But why did Jesus teach? He taught because He knew that the truth sets people free. But the truth must be taught to set people free. And now we must teach. I must teach, and you must teach. For you see, teaching is not merely an option. Jesus turned an option into a commission, the Great Commission. Remember His command to go into the whole world and to teach them to obey everything He's commanded? We've all been commissioned to teach. But so few of us feel adequate to teach, don't we? So few of us have been properly trained on how to teach. I mean, do you know how to actually teach your children so they'll grow up the way you want them to? Or must our children's futures depend upon our hopes and our dreams rather than our instruction? And when you open the scriptures to teach your Sunday school class, do you know how to prepare a lesson that makes the Bible come alive? Do you know the secrets behind how to teach so people really get helped? I mean, in a way that goes beyond their notes and right into their hearts and sets them free. Well, now you know it. Now it's clear. Jesus Christ made teaching a part of your calling, friend. Not just mine, not just your pastor's, but every single Christian has been commissioned by Christ to go and to teach. Therefore, never let it be heard again, but I just can't teach. Why? Because the Lord will always enable you to do what He's commanded. It's because of Christ's great commission that we've prepared this series, The Seven Laws of the Learner.
Welcome to the Seven Laws of the Learner video series. Our seven laws actually spell the word learner. They are learner, expectation, application, retention, need, equipping, and revival. Our first law is the law of the learner. And here to tell you about the law of the learner is the founder and president of Walk Through the Bible, Dr. Bruce Wilkinson.
I'm going to give you an opening story about a man named Dr. Howard Hendricks. How many of you know who he is? He's a dynamic communicator, and he's the person that I eventually went to Dallas Seminary to listen to. I went to seminary basically because I heard him teach, and every time I heard him teach, I said to myself, I want to sit under that man. And I went to listen to him, and I majored in him more than any other subject. Everything that he taught, I took. I took courses I had absolutely no interest in taking, you know, camping. I took camping because of how Dr. Hendricks taught. And I watched this master teacher teach 4 years worth of teaching, 350 different hours studying. How did he do it? Till I had it down for an exact pattern. I knew exactly what he was going to do before he did it. And I decided in my last year of seminary to give the man a test. I never told him about this test till years later. But I decided to go into class and not to pay attention. That no matter what he was going to try and do, I was not going to pay attention to see what he would do. Well, there were 30 of us in class. And there was one window in the class overlooking a parking lot. And it was right where this man right here is. So I sat right where he is, and I decided for the entire hour I was going to look out the window and just see what he would do. I took off my watch, I set it down on the desk, and I looked out the window, asking myself the question, what will a master teacher do if one student will not pay attention? Well, we watched him for years. You could see him underneath his oak desk. At about 3 minutes before the hour would begin, you would see his left knee begin to bounce. It's almost like he wound up. You don't see too many women doing this, but men, their knees bounce. I remember growing up, my mother said, stop, stop, stop that. Your knees just bounce, warming up almost. And then you could set your watch. His right hand would come sliding off the desk and say, all right, gentlemen, and he'd give you a one-liner that was so good. Everybody in the class, we'd be off and running. And usually, about 6 or 7 minutes into the class, he'd tell his first joke. About 8 or 9 minutes, he'd get up out of the desk and he'd go over to the whiteboard behind it and he'd begin to draw a chart. So I was timing this, studying what he would do. Well, he noticed right away, you can't miss it with 30 students in the class. This person right over here isn't paying attention. Well, he stopped teaching in the middle of about his first minute and told the joke. Now, the joke was totally out of context. He was telling the joke to get me. And I knew if I laughed, he would know I was paying attention. So I put my hand over my mouth just to continue looking out the window. So he told the joke. Everybody else laughed. I didn't laugh. About 2 minutes, he gets up out of his chair. He's 6 minutes early. He gets up out of his chair. He walks back to his blackboard, and he begins to draw. Now, he always picked up the same one, the red the blue magic marker first. He began to draw his chart, and he noticed I wasn't copying down the chart. I had my friend copying down the chart for me. And he noticed, he stopped his chart in the middle. He put his pen down. He was in the middle of it. And he walked over to the edge of the platform, right here, which was about in proportion right here. And he was lecturing like this to me down the corner. I was sweating about this time. He gets off of the platform, I'm right here, and he stands in the corner of the room, lecturing like this. I'm concentrating on the window. Just look out the window. Looked at my watch. 3 minutes and 37 seconds. The chairman of the department runs down the aisle and says, "Wilkinson, what on earth's outside that window?" Said, "Nothing, Prof, sorry," and just turned around. Never told him what I was doing. 3 minutes and 37 seconds. He couldn't tolerate it. He set aside his joke. He got out of his seat early. He began to draw a chart on the back, and he then got up and stopped his chart. He stood in the corner. He ran down and he yelled at one of his students because one of the students would not be paying attention. And I thought to myself, isn't that refreshing? And then I got out of that class, and I, fully thinking about this, moved to the next class where somebody else was teaching who had a totally different philosophy than Dr. Howard Hendricks. I remember how we used to sit in his class. This side of the class would be those who wanted to pay attention, and this group wanted to do their Hebrew for the class that followed it. And so this group would just come do other homework, and he had in his mind, if you don't want to pay attention, it's not my problem. And he would come over, and he would sit on the edge of the desk and just talk to this side of the room who was paying attention. In his mind, he said to himself, it's not my problem if you don't want to learn. If you don't want to learn, that's fine. I'm here to give you the information. But on the flip side of that, Dr. Hendricks somehow had on the basis of his own thinking that if you're not learning, it's my problem. That I'm the one who's supposed to cause you to learn. And the second teacher had in the back of his mind that it's not my responsibility to cause you to learn. It's my responsibility to cover the material. Now think back for a moment. I asked somebody today at the hotel, how many great teachers did you have? And the young man said to me, I don't think I had more than one great teacher. I said, did most of the teachers care if you learned it? And he laughed out loud. He said, no, they don't care if you learned it. They just wanted to go through their material and take the test. That's one idea. That's the common thought. But here's a Dr. Hendricks over here who has on the back of his mind the thought that says, if you're not learning, it's my problem. I'll leave the 99 sheep that are with me, and I'll go after the one that's not with me. If that happened in your last class that you taught and some rascal came in and decided to look out the window, would you have even noticed they were looking out the window? Or have you bitten into the mindset that says, it's not my responsibility to cause you to learn. If you don't want to listen, that's not my problem. What's God's impression of that? Can you really divorce teaching from learning and saying, teaching is what the teacher does? Whether or not the student learns or not, I can be a great teacher. Can we make that divorce? Well, in your notebook, take a look at the mindset. And there's two passages here I want to look at with you. One of them is Deuteronomy 4:1, and the other one is Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 1. Deuteronomy 4:1 says, "Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live, and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you." And the question I had in my mind is, what does the Bible mean when it says, I teach? What does it mean to teach? The second verse is very similar to the first, only it flips it around. It's Deuteronomy 5:1, and it says, "And Moses called all Israel and said to them, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your hearing today, that you may learn them." Question, what does it mean to learn? So the next thing I did is what you probably would do. I brought out my Hebrew Old Testament to look up the word teach and to look up the word learn. And there it is. Deuteronomy 4:1 and Deuteronomy 5:1. Helps a lot, doesn't it? Well, here is the word teach right here. And here is the word learn. What does it mean to teach and to learn? So I took out a piece of paper and I wrote those two Hebrew words down. This one means to learn. And this one means to teach. And then I said to myself, well, that's a prefix and that's a suffix. In Hebrew, that's the root of the word, and it's the letters L-M-D, Lamad. What does it mean to learn? So the next thing I did is I went out to my Hebrew dictionary to look up the word Lamad, looking for a helpful insight. This is why you go to seminary, to find an insight, some pay dirt, some gold. So I looked up the word Lamad, saying to myself, what does it really mean? It means to learn. I kept on looking down further and further, and there it is, Deuteronomy 5:1. It means to learn something, not pay dirt. Well, the next thing I go is I go back to that word, and I say, now, what does it mean to teach? And I looked up that word and realized that's a prefix, and there is no suffix there, and that's the letters L-M-D. Wait a minute, you can't tell me that the same word means to learn as it does to teach. Because if it did, do you realize the significance? Never again could we say, I'm a great teacher if my students aren't learning. That God wanted to make a point, and he didn't want to stutter when he made it. And that is, when teaching and learning are talked about, they're the same word. That I have not taught unless you have learned. So I went back to my dictionary and looked up the word to teach. There it was, the same word, Lamad. Kept looking further down, further down, further down, and there it is, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 1, to teach. Well, that's the root. The root means to learn, but when you put it in the PL, it means to teach. Therefore, I had to question, what happens when you put a word in the PL? I'm getting a little technical here, but I want you to see something. So what I did is I looked up my Hebrew grammar book to find out what it means in the PL. This is really helpful. It says, the fundamental idea of the PL is to busy oneself eagerly, look at this, to busy oneself eagerly with the action indicated by the stem. What is the stem? To learn. If I put the word to learn in the PL, it means to busy oneself eagerly with your learning. Look down a little bit further. It means to urge, to cause others to do the same. Hence, it means learn, and the PL means to teach. It's causing someone. It's an eager pursuit of an action. And the issue here is that when God says, go teach, he doesn't mean it's what the teacher does. It means it's what takes place in the life of the student. When I teach, therefore, as far as God's concerned, it's not what the teacher does up front. It's not the material the teacher has. It's not the gestures the teacher has. It's nothing that the teacher does. Teaching is what takes place in your life. And if you haven't learned, then I haven't taught. You see how God says you can't make this separation? You have to bring them together. There has to be a marriage in there. How do you know if you have a great teacher? Answer, did you learn a lot? And the issue of the PL is, I'm supposed to urge you and cause you and chase after you until you start learning. That's why Hendricks got out of everything, went down the aisle and yelled at a senior graduate student because it drove him up the proverbial wall. Why did it drive him up a wall? Because he knew he stopped teaching. He stopped teaching because I wasn't learning. 99% of us keep right on talking because we've defined teaching as talking. And we've said, it makes no difference whether you're learning it or not. My job is to cover the material. Ladies and gentlemen, your job is not to cover the material. My job is to cause the person to learn. And if they're not learning, stop covering the material. Are you with me? Very quiet out there. A lot of this. How many of you had teachers that thought their job was to cover the material? Yeah, can you imagine what would happen if they changed their mind and decided to be a biblical teacher? Well, let's see if we can't summarize that on that chart called the APL model. On the left-hand box, let's put down the word teacher, or speaker. Now, on the right-hand box, put down the word student. And in the middle, with the open book there, is the subject. the subject. What typically happens is the teacher thinks their responsibility is to focus, notice that arrow there, the arrow is focused on the subject. And the teacher thinks their responsibility is to lecture about the subject. And the student thinks their job is to listen. The teacher thinks their job is to give out words. And the student thinks their job is to write those words. Now, I don't know what it was like when you went to school or are going to school, but oftentimes in so many of the classes we attended, what took place as the teacher just went on and we wrote and wrote, nothing went in gear except our hands. And we call that the pit of passivity. And indeed, learning was not taking place. Now, what is the biblical concept of teaching then, my friends? You see how the focus is? The focus of the teachers on the subject. The focus of the students on the subject. God's trying to say the subject is not supposed to be the focus of the teacher. You can ask a teacher, what do you teach? I teach math. Well, if you teach math, it's not the same as I teach students math. A lot of people teach math whose students did not learn math. The Bible would say then that they did not teach. They covered the material. You know what covering material looks like? Let me cover the material. Therefore, if you wanted to get the biblical perspective, to be a biblical teacher or speaker, it is to cause to learn. Cause to learn. It's a realization that my focus is on the students. It's on that person saying, are you getting it or not? Because if you're not getting it, I'm not teaching. Let's see if we can't get a little bigger handle on this. Take a look at the next section, which is called the APL Maxims. And those maxims are principles, big ideas, about how learning takes place. And I want to see if we can't deepen your understanding of it. The first one is, teachers are responsible to cause the students to learn. It's the teacher who's the one who's responsible. I remember coming back from a conference like this where I brought my teenage son with me. And the next day he went to his school class and his high school. And he came back and he said at the dinner time, he said, Dad, those teachers, they need to come to your class. They're not causing me to learn. And I knew something was coming and he smiled and he said, well, you know, Dad, those math grades, they're not my fault. They're not causing me to learn. And my wife looked across the table like, what are you teaching my son? And I said to Dave, I said, well, Dave, you need to know the law of the student. The student is responsible to learn regardless of the quality of the teacher. Now, I'm not here to teach you how to be a better learner. I'm going to flip that over. My job tonight in this conference is to teach you how to be a better teacher that causes the student to learn. But unless you assume the responsibility of causing that person to learn, you can forget ever being a great teacher. All great teachers have way down in the deep side of their heart that belief that says, it's my responsibility to cause you to learn. It's like Winston Churchill once said. He said, personally, I'm always ready to learn, although I don't always like to be taught. It's like your grandmother. Maybe you can remember this growing up, where your grandmother gets kind of frustrated with you and she gets over you and starts waggling that finger and she says, I'm going to learn you, young man. Remember that? I'm going to not teach you, I'm going to learn you. She was so intent on you getting it, she realized the whole point is, did you learn it? Guy Dowd, who was the National Teacher of the Year, he said, I suspected that this teacher that he had would feel that if I had failed, she had failed. And she seemed bound and determined to teach me. She gave me back my hope. Do you feel as a teacher, if they're not learning, you're failing? It's a whole different approach, isn't it? Number two, second maxim. Teachers will stand accountable to God for their influence. Teachers will stand accountable to God for their influence. That's a heavy maxim. I want you to write down two verses beneath that. That's James chapter 3, verse 1. James chapter 3, verse 1, and Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17. James chapter 3, verse 1 goes like this. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. Look at that. Let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we, that is those of us who become teachers, shall receive a stricter judgment. Judgment from whom? From God. But if I'm not responsible, then how can God hold me accountable? The point of it is, I am responsible. That's why I can be held accountable. And I'm going to be held accountable on a more strict basis because of the amount of responsibility that I have. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17 says, obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls as those who must give account. Must give account. And I think when Dr. Hendricks changed all those gears and eventually walked down the aisle, he had way back in the back of his mind that God's holding him accountable to cause me to learn. Number three, teachers are responsible because they can control the big four: the subject, the style, the setting, and the speaker. The subject, the style, the setting, and the speaker. How can a person be responsible? How can a person be responsible? Can you make someone learn who doesn't want to learn? You can't do it. You can't force someone to learn. What can you do then? Well, you can come down to this person and say, what's in my control? What's in my control is my subject, because they can control subject. That is, I can change my mind right now and start talking about our president if I wanted to. You're not in control of that. I'm in control of that. And if I'm not holding your attention with the subject I'm doing, I have everything in my power to change the subject and make it different. It's in my control. I control the subject to influence you to learn. I also control, number two, the style. I can have a real quiet style. I can all of a sudden start becoming very animated if you're not with it too much. I'm in control of my style. And I can stand right next to Roger and say, Roger, how are you? Poor Roger didn't have a chance. Like that person was looking at the window. I did not have a chance when Hendrick said what he said. I had to pay attention. See, if you think in the back of your mind, I'm the one who's responsible, you start getting after the student. You start changing it. The style, the setting. You can have people stand up, get in small groups, walk outside, stand and sing. You're in control of it. You're also in control of yourself. The speaker. I can sit down. I can be quiet. I can take out pictures of my family and show them to you. I'm in control. But what I'm not in control of is I'm not in control of you. But I can use those four different things to get after you so that it causes you to learn and respond. I was trying to teach this to one of my friends one time, and he said to me, that reminds me of a famous Latin essay. And I said, a Latin essay? He said, yeah. And he says, it's trying to say the same thing that you're saying, that is, that the teacher's in control. He says, I think I have that at home in my Latin book. So he brought the Latin book to the office, and I have a copy of it right here. There it is in Latin. And there is one part of this that is right down to the point where we're trying to make, and that is, Lort Noc Nisi Receta. A teacher's in control. That's a very important phrase, and I want you to know that. Would you say it with me? Lort Noc Nisi Receta. Ready? Lort Noc Nisi. Say it again. Lort Noc Nisi Receta. Don't look at it. Look at me. I want you to know this. You always know Latin from now on. Just the women. Tell it to me. Ready? Just the men? Now, tell it to two people next to you. Quickly, quickly. All right, say it for me. Ready? Lort Noc Nisi Receta. Now, what that essay is trying to say is that a teacher is in control. And I want you to look at that for a minute, Lort Noc Nisi Receta, because it's not Latin. Take a look at it real closely, backwards. A teacher is in control. why did we do that? God, I promise I'll never do this again. Why did I do that? I was sitting in my office one day saying, how can I validate to a group of adults how much a teacher's in control? And I said to myself, if I can get a group of adults saying nonsense together, my friends, you and I are in control. Now, maybe you'd be saying, yeah, but you don't know my class. What you've just said is they're in control. Isn't it interesting that a very disruptive class, that teacher gets sick, and a substitute comes walking in who knows about Lord Nakanishi Riketa and knows how to use subject style setting in the speaker, and in a few short minutes, that class is over. Just like that. It's a brand new class. People are listening on the edge of their seat, involved, discussing. Why? It's the teacher's in control. It's not the class, it's the teacher who is in control. Lort Nak Nisi Riketa. Shirley Hufstedler, the former U.S. Secretary of Education, said the secret of being a successful teacher is to accept in a very personal way the responsibility for each student's success or failure. Those teachers who do take personal responsibility for their students' successes and failure tend to produce higher achieving students. So whose responsibility is it? All right, number four. Teachers should judge their success by the success of their student. By the success of their student. How do you know if you have a really great painter? Answer, by his degrees, what art school he went to. How do you know if you have a great teacher? See, it's interesting how we confuse the matter. Well, he has all these degrees, he's written all these books, she serves on all these committees. How do you know if you have a great teacher? See, it's that divorce again. The great teachers are the ones who have the great students. I remember giving this one time in Baltimore. And at a break, a well-dressed 55-year-old man came up, grayish hair, $700 suit it looked like. And he said to me, I own my own companies and I'm back in school getting my MBA. I said, well, that's exciting. That's good. He said, well, I was in the middle of my coursework and I came to this one class and the woman who was teaching it first hour, she said, you know, this is a very difficult course and 70% of you are going to fail this course. He said, when I heard her say that, I said to myself, man, what a teacher she must be. He said, now I have a whole different impression of what kind of teacher she is. 75% of her class failed. How did she do? She was a failure as a teacher. How do you know if you're a good teacher? Answer, by what on earth your students are doing. It's not what you're doing up front that counts, but did they get it or not? Number five, teachers impact more by their character and commitment than by their communication. You see, it's your character that speaks more loudly than your words, doesn't it? If you think back on those men and women that have been your greatest teachers, I dare say you probably don't remember much what they said, but it was the character of the person that kept on saying it and saying it and saying it. Number six, teachers exist. They exist to serve the students. Guy Dowd, who was a National Teacher of the Year, said, my job isn't so much to teach as it is to help students learn. You can teach to a wall, but when you help someone learn, you have to get involved with the whole person. And the issue is, you got to serve the students. What does it mean to serve the students? It means to get behind them and give them anything they need so that they will learn. The last one that I want you to show you tonight is number seven. And that is, teachers who practice the APL laws can become master teachers. See, somehow we think that great teachers are hatched. They're not hatched. They're not manufactured. Great teachers are improved a little bit at a time. You see, there are some universal laws. If I were to take this pen and let it go, which direction would it go? down. If I dropped it 10 times, how many times out of 10 would it fall down? Now, if I got out of the picture and I gave it to you and let you drop it, which way would it go? And if I went to Brazil on the other part of the world and gave it to somebody on the street and I said to a little boy, "Will you drop this pen, which direction would it fall?" You know, why would they all fall down? It's so obvious. It fall down because there's a universal principle at law, isn't it? We didn't make gravity. We uncovered it. And now we're using it, aren't we? Well, there are same kinds of laws in teaching and communication between one person and another person, or one person and a mass of people. Those laws, universal laws. Some people have learned how to master the laws of boredom. No matter what they're teaching or what group they're teaching, they're boring every single time. In the morning, they're boring. In the afternoon, they're boring. At nighttime, they're boring. They're boring teaching the Bible. They're boring teaching math. Why? They've learned over the years how to master boredom. Now, other people have learned how to master excitement and innovation and effective teaching, that no matter when, where, or who they're teaching, it's the exact opposite. And we think it's personality when it isn't personality, because anybody can drop the pen. And anybody can teach in a monotone, "This is a very exciting time in my life, and I'm really very happy to be here tonight. It's really going to change your life very much, and there's 17 points we're going to give here." And you talk like that, and what are you going to do? You're going to bore people 100 times out of 100. Well, flip it over. Just as there's laws governing boredom, there's also laws governing the positive side of it. And that's what we want to talk about. And our challenge for you and for all of us in this law is that you would become a Lort Nachnisi grad through all of this. And that slowly your mindset of how to think about teaching and communication as you go through each of these laws would begin to change, and your mind would become appleized. You'd become different in how you think about it. And the mindset and the meaning that we want you to have is the APL meaning of this law, which is to cause to learn. To cause to learn. The teacher should accept the responsibility of causing students to learn.
There's a very powerful quote by a frustrated inner city father when he's talked to the school board about what he saw happening to his daughter at school. It goes something like this: "You people operate a monopoly, like the telephone company. I got no choice where I send my child to school. I can only go where it's free, and she's not learning. That's your responsibility. It's the responsibility of the principal. It's the teacher's responsibility that she's not learning. And when you fail, when everybody else fails my child, what happens? Nothing. Nobody gets fired. Nothing happens to nobody except my child." If you were that inner city father, how do you think you'd feel? And how do you think our heavenly Father feels? My friends, there must be a better way. And there is a better way. And that's the better way we want to talk to you about in this course. It's God's way. It's Champions for Christ in the Classroom. Let me wrap up part one of the Law of the Learner. I simply have one question for you. Will you, right now, accept the responsibility in your own heart to cause your students to learn? That regardless of what it takes, regardless of what's going on, that you're going to pick up the mantle of the master and cause your students to learn every time you teach. Since that's the kind of teacher you want to be, and we at Walk Through the Bible want to be partners with you. We want to make all of the resources of Walk Through the Bible available to you to see that you become the kind of teacher that God wants you to be. You see, that's the challenge of the whole course. And next time in part two of the Law of the Learner, we'll show you how to become God's kind of a teacher.